I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
It's pledge drive here at VPR, as I'm sure you've noticed, and Vermont Edition is getting into it a little bit as well. What we're trying to do during this fund drive is remind you of all of the various things we cover on Vermont Edition, and in particular, how we do it over the course of time through multiple angles. So today, we're going to focus on some of our recent episodes about climate change. After the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published its report last October, we did several shows that looked at different ways our climate is changing and what Vermonters are or can be doing about it. The grim picture that report painted was enough to give anyone pause. Rising temperatures, massive storms, species extinction. And that's not to mention the effects that global climate change could have on the economy and many local industries. According to the study, our region, the Northeast, will see changes much earlier than previously expected. In fact, the Northeast is projected to be more than 3.6 degrees warmer than pre-industrial times before the next two decades are up. Helping us to digest some of these facts, specifically those concerning our own weather and rising temperatures, was Jason Schaefer. He's professor of atmospheric sciences and director of the Vermont Institute of Applied Meteorology. In our episode just after the report, I asked Schaefer about the proposed temperature increase that's predicted for our region. In the big picture, what does it mean that the Northeast will have the largest forecast temperature increase in the lower 48?
It means that our temperatures are warming at a pretty rapid rate, and that rate is not distributed over the seasons equally. In particular, it's warming faster in the wintertime. So a lot of our climate signals we're seeing, our signals are strongest in the wintertime.
Why is the Northeast warming faster than the rest of the country?
Well, a lot of it comes down to water and temperatures, how they're affected by water in the atmosphere. The climate is generally getting wetter and warmer, and as it gets wetter, it positively feeds back to it. So the nighttime temperatures in the middle of wintertime are actually warming the fastest of all the temperatures we look at because there's more moisture in the atmosphere, and that acts as a good greenhouse gas. So not as much as the heat goes back out to space when you have more moisture in it. And in the summertime, the same thing is true. The nighttime low temperatures are just a little bit warmer as well.
All right, so let's talk about some of the things that people can see and feel and experience and things that are happening now and what might happen in the future.
We're in a unique place for the wintertime. We go above and below 32 degrees pretty often, and we get lots of precipitation and a pretty active pattern of the jet stream. And we see it now currently. We're going to have more opportunities to have more precipitation during the wintertime when it's around 32 degrees. And the problem is usually when you're right around 32 degrees because the snow tends to be wet and sticky and cause more problems, and then you could have more cold air at the surface and warm air on top of that, and you can get things like freezing rain and ice storms. The storms are going to getting wetter, and in the wintertime, we're seeing more snowfall, in fact, in parts of northern Vermont until the climate's too warm for that to happen. Basically, in northern Vermont, especially in the mountains, we're still cold enough that that extra precipitation still falls as snow before it gets too warm and falls more as rain. And that type of behavior of storms actually becoming stronger and slowing down is something that's consistent with climate changing as well. As well, we're getting into more wet periods and then also really strong dry periods. We had drought this summer in northern Vermont, whereas southern Vermont had above average wetness.
So that's one of the features of climate change as well, is that you see very different situations in different parts of the country. And in this instance, within a micro region, you know, it's sort of southern Vermont versus northern Vermont, really different kinds of climates for the or weather-related patterns for the summertime.
I would say in general that the seasons are just less reliable and more anomalous in that you're seeing different types of weather you might not expect at different times of the year. And the other thing we're also seeing in the wintertime is we're seeing a lot more thaws, a lot more rain on snow. So even though you're getting more snow, doesn't mean the quality of that snow is good. I think that we have a pretty informed scientific consensus on what's happening with our climate system. And weather can be hard to forecast, but the directions of where climate is going and our contributions to it are pretty clear in that we're putting a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's this very strong greenhouse gas. It's just the laws of physics. We can't get around that, and there's a lot that we need to do to try to mitigate, and then if we can't mitigate, to try to adapt to climate change.
We're talking right now about weather and weather patterns and climate change. We're jumping off this new report that looks at the U.S. climate and how it's changing and points out specifically that the Northeast is warming more rapidly than other parts of the country. And we're trying to address today a little bit of what that looks like, what that means, what we're already seeing and what we might be seeing in the next two decades or so as we see our average temperature rise as much as 3.6 degrees by 2035. So you mentioned, Jason, a little bit of what we might see in the summertime. So we talked a little bit about winter in the short range, more snow perhaps, but less stability, less of a sense of, okay, this is the norm, this is what's likely to happen. And in the summertime, as you said, in northern Vermont, we had a drought. In southern Vermont, we had more water. What else might we see during these seasons that, while unpredictable, is predicted?
Things like summertime thunderstorms, we don't necessarily know a whole lot about in terms of how that's going to change things. The nighttime temperatures throughout the year will continue to get warmer, and there's other impacts on insects and health, human health potentially. If you get more heat waves, heat actually, in terms of global health impacts, causes more deaths than anything else. And we don't tend to get a lot of heat waves here, but those will probably become a little more likely in the next 5, 10, 20 years across Vermont.
What should we be on the lookout for in terms of how we might need to respond?
I think we just have to have a mindset of resilience and a willingness that we're all going to have to pay for this one way or another. You know, how what that means for individual decisions, it really depends on everyone's situation. But when nature strikes and the storms are powerful, we just have to be ready to be hardened and ready to respond to that.
That's Jason Schaefer, a professor of atmospheric sciences and director of the Vermont Institute of Applied Meteorology at Northern Vermont University. Jason, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're jumping off the National Climate Assessment that shows the Northeast warming faster than other parts of the country. We are looking at signs already present here and what we might expect in the next 20 years. We already talked about weather, and now we're going to look at animals. Tom Rogers is a biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Department in Vermont, and he joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about what biologists are already observing when it comes to climate change and Vermont's animals?
So one of the flagship species for climate change in Vermont is our moose population. People hear a lot about winter ticks, and winter ticks are a different species than the black-legged ticks that we all know from Lyme disease. Winter ticks are primarily affecting moose in Vermont, and they've become much more prolific as springs become less snowier and falls become milder. And so right now we're in the middle of a three-year-long study where we've radio-collared moose, and we're trying to figure out what the trends are, what's killing moose in the state of Vermont, and what we can do to try to help them.
What about other species? I'm thinking of bears, for example. We know that bears sometimes come out of hibernation when we have thaws or when the weather is warm. Are we seeing changes in bear behavior?
That's right. Our bear biologist is observing more reports of bears being out and about in the wintertime. Bears, unlike a lot of species, don't actually go into true hibernation. They're mostly just in what's called winter dormancy for the winter, meaning that they're mostly just sleeping, and so they're easily aroused. And so a nice, cold, snowy winter where the snowpack will seal up their den and kind of keep them sheltered and protected from the cold temperatures and the winds, they'll sleep throughout the entire winter. Whereas if you get, as Jason mentioned, a lot of these winter rain events or really unpredictable winter weather, that can be hard for bears, and they can actually get flooded out of their dens and be out and about in the wintertime, where previously we wouldn't see that nearly as much.
Are you seeing other animals react to those unpredictable changes and more thaws?
You know, unpredictability is exactly the right word. So that's really difficult for wildlife to adapt to. Previously, wildlife had, you know, centuries or millennia to adapt to changes in climate. And now it's happening so quickly that we're not sure that all the species are going to be able to keep up with it. So, for instance, when birds are migrating, when the insects are popping out as a result of the buds coming out, all of that is changing really fast. And it can sometimes be difficult for wildlife to adapt to that. We saw bluebirds nesting and wood ducks present at Dead Creek on February 24th. So, you know, that's kind of early for some of those behaviors. The other big thing is that a lot of the invasive species in Vermont are much more flexible and adaptable to this unpredictability. And so they can change very rapidly as a result of climate change, whereas a lot of our native species might not be able to. So, for example, we're seeing that purple loosestrife, an invasive plant, is blooming earlier in the year as a result of warmer springs, whereas our native cattails are not keeping up. They're not blooming quite as early.
Tom Rogers, as we see the Northeast warm, are we going to be seeing new species coming into this region because it's either more like what they've experienced previously in southern regions or they're just more able to be here when they weren't in the past?
And in regards to venomous snakes, Jane, as you well know, we actually have a population of venomous snakes. We have native timber rattlesnakes right here in Vermont already. But absolutely, we are seeing some new species in the state, and we probably expect to continue to see new species, not just species that are easily able to move, such as animals, but even some plants that are probably going to be migrating northward across the landscape in a changing climate. So black vultures, we're starting to see. Coyotes, a newer species over the last half century to Vermont, and that's just as much a result of, you know, land use changes and other things as climate change. But we do absolutely expect to see more species in Vermont. And there's a lot of discussion as to what we can do or what we should be doing to help facilitate that. So some people talk about, you know, a rare plant that exists only on mountaintops in the Smoky Mountains. As climate changes, what is the ethical decision as to whether or not we should be moving that, say, to the top of Mount Mansfield, where the conditions are going to be more like what it was used to? And there's really no single consensus on how scientists should be responding to that.
What do you think?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. It's a matter of, it's not just the climate that necessarily something is adapted to. There are all kinds of biotic and abiotic factors. And so there are a lot of ins and outs of moving species from one area to another. You know, there's no right or wrong way answer. And I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis per species.
Judith emailed in to say one of the primary things we are seeing out on the dirt roads as our climate changes is multiple mud seasons. It used to be we could count on a solid mud season in maybe late March through mid-April. We now get 10 or more mud seasons throughout the winter. This wreaks havoc on the roads, the cars, and the town highway budgets. Tom, you've talked about some of the issues that we're seeing. A lot of invasive species that are able to adapt more quickly, gaining more of a foothold here, while in some of our native species that can't adapt to the changing climate and changing agriculture as quickly, having a problem. What can we do?
There are a lot of things we can do. This is a great thing. So everything we do in the Fish and Wildlife Department and with our partners as well, we have climate change in mind in those management actions. So the single greatest thing we can do really is maintaining healthy and connected habitats. Climate change is going to accelerate a lot of those threats that you talked about, invasive species, habitat fragmentation, habitat loss. And so we are really working hard to make sure that Vermont has healthy and connected habitats so that as wildlife need to adapt to all this unpredictability and all these changing climates, that they can find the resources they need in the different seasons. They can move from one place to the next.
That was Tom Rogers of Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department talking about some of the changes to animal species and populations we might expect in the next couple of decades. We're listening back today to shows about climate change and specifically how it could affect where we live, work, and play. Let's continue to look at some of the effects on animal species on Vermont, but we'll go from big now to small, specifically insects. A recent peer-reviewed paper published in the journal Biological Conservation presented some alarming facts. Over 40% of insect species are threatened with extinction. That's globally. Insects are dying off at a rate of 2.5% a year. At that rate, the scientists in this paper suggested it could spell the near total elimination of all insects in the next century. But some people say that's not exactly true. Many insects are likely to survive even an apocalypse. So how do we make sense of all this? Well, we called on three local insect experts, Leif Richardson, an ecologist at UVM's Gund Institute for Environment and the Rubenstein School of Environmental and Natural Resources, Brian Pfeiffer, a field entomologist and writer, and Mark Ferguson, a zoologist with Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department. I began by asking Brian Pfeiffer if insects are already in the sixth great mass extinction.
They've already survived five mass extinctions. These animals have been on the planet for, 400 million years or so, which is about 2,000 times longer than we have. Dinosaurs were a passing fad to them. And if we are in the middle of one of these great mass extinctions, insects will survive it. They are durable animals, far more durable than us. But that we're talking about this, and we're talking in apocalyptic terms about insects, suggests that our footprint is pretty powerful if we can have an impact on these animals that have been here for so long and are so durable.
Brian, do you have a sense of why insects are declining more precipitously than other types of animals?
Yeah, I think we can say with a fair amount of certainty that it is largely human activity. But the amazing thing now, and I think one of the reasons this is getting so much attention, is that we haven't known much about insects, despite their being here for so long. We're only now beginning to understand what's happening with their distributions and their populations. Taken as a whole, this massive group of organisms, more diverse than any other, we're only now starting to get a sense of these population trends.
Leif Richardson, I know you're among the people who wants to pump the brakes a little bit on what people have been hearing from this study. And people are looking at this and saying, holy smokes, we could see every insect on the planet be gone in 100 years. And Brian is saying, probably not, given how well insects have survived in the past. But a lot of insects could be gone, and especially insects that are really crucial to human existence. How do you see this report itself and where we should take certain things with a grain of salt while also being very concerned about insects in general?
I largely agree with Brian that, yes, we probably are in the sixth great extinction event, and that insects are in trouble, along with many other taxa. This publication has generated a lot of discussion because it makes claims that insects will be gone within a century that many of us just don't find plausible, given the evidence that the paper marshals. Yes, there are probably very serious issues with insect declines that we need to talk about, but no, there's not enough evidence to suggest that all insects will be gone in a century. It's actually a really great review of the drivers of insect decline and what is known about individual taxa. So I think it's good work. The frame of the paper was to search for articles about insects, declines, and something like long-term monitoring. And so that's not wrong, but if you do that, you will find studies that report declines of insects. You won't find studies necessarily that report increases of insects, right? So the paper was designed to look at what we know about declines, not to ask the question, are they declining or not? We think there are more than 5 million insect species on Earth, and about 80% of those are still undescribed. So not only have we not asked the question, are they in decline, we don't even know what their names are. So I think a key theme to this discussion is the uncertainty that exists. So we know there's a problem, but it's impossible to say just how big the problem is, given how much uncertainty there is.
Mark Ferguson, from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department perspective, do you look at a report like this and think, uh-oh, or do you say, good, people are paying attention to this, let's make hay now because this is something that's on people's minds and maybe we can make some progress?
It's definitely the latter. It's always good for the public to share our interest and for us to have that support behind the work that we do. You know, it was not that long ago that we really didn't have much funding or, you know, the support to do work on invertebrates. But in the last 15 years, it's been much better.
What is Vermont doing to at least know what we have, to know then later what we might see growth in or what we might lose by 2050 or 2070?
And we've been addressing that over the last 10 or 15 years by doing a number of different large-scale projects where we look at, trying to identify what species we have and where we can, some indication of abundance or at least relative abundance. So one of the great things that's happening now is that we're using citizen scientists to help us gather information so we can do a much larger scale of effort than we could before. And this is becoming more popular and people are starting to really get into it. So it's great.
The other amazing thing about this is that insects sort of defy simplicity. You know, they like exemplify nuance and diversity in all this intellectual curiosity. There are, for example, 2,200 moth species in Vermont that we know of. But there's only 200 bird species, 10 times more moths than there are birds in terms of diversity. That's the thing with insects. Almost invariably, there's never one of them. You know, so that's what's the challenge and the wonder of insects.
So, Leif, what about it? I mean, why should we be so concerned about a loss of insects?
There are a number of very important functions that insects perform in the ecosystem, and in our human economies. They're very abundant, right? There's just huge biomass of insects, many different species and individuals of them. So they form the base of many food webs. They're important to predator-prey interactions. They're an important structural part of the ecosystems around us. So Vermont's forests and wetlands and other types of natural systems would not be the same without the insects there. I also want to highlight that we get many what we call ecosystem services from insects, our food production systems, because native bees and other insects are very important pollinators. We also get the service of natural pest control from the predators of some of the bugs that chew on our plants in our gardens and our farms. There are some others also. So when we think about the loss of insects, we're thinking about impoverishment of natural systems, but we're also talking about the human economy. And we are potentially losing a large sum of money when we lose these native insects.
That was Leif Richardson at UVM on a recent Vermont Edition episode discussing climate change's impact on Vermont's insect populations. You also heard from field entomologist and writer Brian Pfeiffer and Mark Ferguson, a zoologist with Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department. You're listening to a special episode of Vermont Edition. Last October, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued findings on how the climate is actually changing faster than scientists had earlier predicted. Today on the show, we're gathering a few segments together to sort of paint a bigger picture of what the effects warmer temperatures might have on our region and our plants, wildlife, agriculture, and on us. So if we know the causes are numerous, where do we begin if we want to pinpoint some possible solutions and things we can actually do? One area we began to explore on Vermont Edition is the impact our diet has on climate change. The central question often posed is, should you stop eating meat to mitigate the effects of climate change? Of course, it isn't as simple, though, as just embracing meatless Mondays. To help us navigate the topic, we spoke with Meredith Niles, a professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Science in the Food Systems Program at the University of Vermont. And I asked her, is it just like go vegan already?
There's not a simple answer, unfortunately. Like many of these challenges around climate change, there really isn't a single solution. But really, there's a lot of things we have to think about. We have to think about diet, but I especially want to impart, we also have to think about food waste.
I don't know how we can solve the problem without knowing what it is. So what is the problem with agriculture and specifically with meat consumption and the way that animals are raised when it comes to global warming?
When we look at global greenhouse gas emissions, what we see is that agriculture and associated land use changes, so deforestation from agriculture, are about 25% of global emissions. When you look at the whole food system, so you add in the transportation, the packaging, the processing, food waste, we're talking about almost a third of total greenhouse gas emissions. So to address our climate challenge, we obviously should be thinking about food systems.
How much within that agriculture sector can be attributed specifically to non-vegan products?
Yeah, so livestock and animal products are around 75% of that agricultural total. But I do want to acknowledge that when we think about agriculture, we're also talking about fertilizer use and cropland management, as well as then issues within livestock production, how manure is managed, how animals are grazed and fed. So there's a lot of complicated factors. In fact, even rice production, for example, contributes to greenhouse gas emissions.
Some of the articles that I've been reading, both since the IPCC report came out, but also since a separate report specifically looking at eating animal products came out, is that the single biggest thing you, an individual, can do to limit your impact on the world is to stop eating animal products. Do you think that's true?
I mean, I think if we look at the most recent IPCC report, their main message wasn't just stop eating animal products. Their main message was consumption, and we should be thinking about consumption across all spheres of our life. So that's how we consume energy, how we transport ourselves, our diet, our material consumptions, what we buy, what we wear. So I think consumption is the broader message here. But acknowledging that food is part of our consumption and something that we can think about to deal with our climate challenges, I think, is really important.
We also got a note from Dave who says, this is more than a little silly. If people won't adopt a vegetarian diet to improve their own health, they certainly aren't going to do it to slow global warming. So, I mean, are we having sort of a pointless conversation here, Professor?
Well, I think that's why we should broaden the conversation, because actually the recent research on sort of the human behavior component of this is really clear. The most people are not willing to change their diets more than about 30%. I think we have to acknowledge that for human behavior, most people aren't going to become vegan and vegetarian. And so we have to think about other options. And that's why I think food waste is a really important conversation as well.
Well, let's go to the food waste segment of that conversation. So, you know, I certainly am guilty of looking in my refrigerator and realizing, oh, shoot, I didn't make that thing that I was going to make and now it's expired. How do we get better at thinking about food waste? And it's not just individuals here either.
So in the United States, what we're really focused on here is across the whole supply chain. So we talk about food loss, which is what's happening at the agricultural level. There's great organizations like Salvation Farms here in Vermont that have fantastic gleaning operations.
For people who aren't familiar with gleaning, this is actually picking things from the field so they don't actually rot in the fields.
That's right. Things that might go unharvested or maybe not have the highest quality. They might not look exactly perfect, but they're still edible. Groups like Salvation Farms partake in those gleaning efforts. But here in the United States, actually, about 50% of our food waste is at the household level. And last year, colleagues of mine at UVM and the USDA, we actually published a study where we found the average American wastes about a pound of food per day at the household level. So we really do have to look in our own refrigerators, as you just said, Jane, and take a hard look at what we're doing and how we can change our behaviors. You know, from a greenhouse gas emissions standpoint, actually, if food waste was a country, it would have the third largest emissions in the entire world. So right behind China and the United States would be food waste. And that's why I think it's a really important part of this conversation.
That's kind of a nutso statistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure, I waste some food, but I compost it, so it goes right back into the soil. I'm doing my part, no problem, right?
Composting, feeding to animals, anaerobic digestion, all these options are fantastic. But if we really want to prevent the greenhouse gas emissions on the front end, on the production, the distribution, the transportation, we need to avoid food waste from happening at all.
How do I make sure that the restaurant I'm going to or the grocery store that I often frequent is not also contributing to that food waste problem?
Sure. Well, here in Vermont, we actually do have a policy that's coming into play by 2020 where food waste has to be diverted from landfills. So there is increasing focus on that here in Vermont. You know, at the household level, I think there's a couple of simple things. First of all, there's some great apps out there. These are apps that help you repurpose leftovers, find new recipes, and also, you know, reminders about, I put this thing in the freezer, take it out in 3 months so it doesn't go bad. So there are some great apps out there that can help us, you know, understand some of these challenges. And I also want to impart, there's economics to this as well. You know, some of the studies on food waste have found that the average family of four could save $1,200 a year if they reduced their food waste and minimized it.
Let's go to Caroy, who's calling in from Starksboro.
I don't think it's quite as simple as people becoming vegan, vegetarian versus meat eaters. And I know that if you feed beef, their natural grass and browse finish diet, first of all, they're not experiencing the high indigestion that mass-produced industrial corn-fed beef do. And they also retain, because they're not basically becoming pre-diabetic before slaughter. So if people became, you know, super intentional about the quality of beef or the meat and how it's raised with respect, with a respectful, loving, care-filled life and a respectful death where they never experience fear or stress, we also don't have that corticosteroid release into their bodies, which, of course, if they're truly fully healthy, their health gets transferred to their consumer.
And Professor Niles, I want to come back to you. But before we do, let's bring in another voice here. Seth Itzkan is co-founder and co-director of Soil for Climate, a Vermont-based nonprofit advocating for soil restoration to reverse global warming. And Seth, it's nice to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So we're starting to go into this question of, is it about, you know, stopping our consumption of animal products, or is it thinking about how the whole process of how we get our food? And it sounds like it's both. Where do you come in on this?
It's definitely the latter. There are new forms of grazing management that offer profound hope for regenerative agriculture, which restores soil, captures carbon, replenishes watersheds, and creates a clean and safe climate future. A University of Texas study has shown 1.2 tons of carbon per acre per year were sequestered using this approach. A Colorado State University study showed 3 tons of carbon per acre per year were sequestered using this approach. And the North American estimate is 0.8 billion tons or 800 million tons of carbon can be sequestered in soil through proper grazing management. That's per year. My own calculation is that Vermont could be capturing 290,000 tons of carbon per year on the pasture lands that it already has using proper grazing management. So I strongly push against the less meat argument, but I stand with the elimination of CAFO argument, but not the elimination of meat. We need to just change how we produce meat, and if we produce it in this regenerative way, it is a very powerful climate solution.
A new study that came out in the journal Science called Reducing Food's Environmental Impacts Through Producers and Consumers said that even the most sustainable meat operations were not as healthy for the planet as some of the least sustainable vegetable operations. So could we, Seth, move from meat and animal products into vegetarian products, you know, vegetables and other plant-based food, and still, you know, do the soil work you're talking about and benefit the planet?
No, that narrative is wrong. And I want to be clear about that. We have to restore approximately 10 billion acres of degraded pasture land around the world. And to do that requires changing the management, but there must be a demand for grass-fed meat. And so we need to be clear about the distinction between, you know, the cheap meats that you get at the supermarket that you know are produced in CAFOs and they're fed soy and all those deleterious indicators that's a legitimate problem. But there's an entirely new methodology evolving, and we need to be championing that methodology. And so I'm strongly advocating against the narrative that says reduce meat. No, we need to eat the same amount of meat, maybe even more. We need to reduce calories from carbohydrates and sugar, but we should be getting calories from good meat. And here in Vermont, there's the Vermont Grass Farmers Association. I'm honored to be on the board of that group. There are 100% pasture-raised meat farmers in Vermont, and they need our help. They need our support. We need to be taking a lead in this movement. I understand the emotional and the historical background to be vegetarian. I was a vegetarian myself for 12 years. But there's a new narrative now, there's new science, and we need to be getting with the program, so to speak, of embracing the type of agriculture that's actually going to draw carbon out of the air. So this is actually an essential strategy for a safe climate.
Professor Niles, you're listening to this. Where do you come in on this conversation?
Well, I completely agree with Seth that we have amazing opportunities in agriculture to support farmers to do these kinds of practices. Certainly looking at soil carbon and its storage in soils has been a huge and growing focus of research, and there's a lot of potential there. I think my point is that we also have other options around food waste and other things that should also be on the table as well, but I completely agree and want to support also the efforts that are happening here in Vermont and beyond for acknowledging the work that farmers are doing to sequester carbon. You know, on the food waste side of that, I think the thing that is so troubling to me is if farmers like the ones that Seth works with and farmers across Vermont are going through all of these practices and all of these transformational changes, and then we're getting things on our plate and we're throwing them away, it's all for nothing. Right.
The more options there are for people to buy grass-fed meat, and the more it's appropriately labeled. I mean, my vision is that there will be labels in the future which actually tell what the carbon footprint of the product is. And if you're in a supermarket or somewhere and you have a local grass-fed meat product where the soil is being sampled by the Extension Office at the University of Vermont, and they can show that the carbon is increasing in that pasture, and next to it is a block of tofu made from soybeans grown in Iowa on what should have been tall grass prairie, there's not going to be any comparison. The more climate responsible choice by far is going to be to buy the local grass-fed meat.
That's Seth Itzcan, co-founder and co-director of Soil for Climate, a Vermont-based nonprofit that advocates for soil restoration to help reverse global warming. Seth, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's my honor.
Meredith Niles, I mean, what about that? Is labeling going to help us through this for consumers who really want to be informed and want to be making good choices? Meat may still be the way to go, but it's all about how it's being produced. I mean, can we get to that kind of really good labeling?
Well, per your commenter's call earlier, a lot of people don't make decisions based on the environment, unfortunately. And we actually have had carbon labels that have been in place. They've been in place in certain countries around the globe within the past 10 years. For example, in the UK, they did a bunch of carbon footprinting, put CO2 labels on foods, and generally people were confused by them. You know, they don't really know what an equivalent of CO2 looks like. So I do think if we are going to move in a labeling direction, first of all, we have to acknowledge what segment of the population has the ability and the choice to make purchases in that way? And two, how do we create them in a way that's really transparent and helps people truly understand what that means?
Today, we're exploring the question of how what we eat affects global climate change and what you can or should be doing about changing your diet. Our guest is Meredith Niles, professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences in the Food Systems Program at UVM. And as she's been telling us, it's a whole food systems approach here. So we're talking not only about what land is being used for animal and plant production, but also how it's produced, how it's transported, how it gets to us, what we do with it, how much we waste. I mean, there's a lot to talk about when we think about how what we eat is affecting the globe and the climate, and then how we can change our decisions and what we might need in terms of extra help from the government or from producers to know what choices to make. I want to bring another voice in here, too, because we're talking a lot about what choices we make to eat. And a lot of the articles that you read right now say go vegan or go meatless. Mark Cesario thinks about it a lot. He's co-owner of Meeting Place Pastures, a grass-fed beef farming operation in Cornwall. How do you weigh what you're doing and how it affects the globe?
A Middlebury College student, Kate Porterfield, a couple of years ago, worked with us to develop a study to try to figure out how much total carbon was I sequestering in the soil. We started farming here in Cornwall in 2009, started with 100 acres. We've grown that to almost about 1,000 acres now, and every year we've taken on a new piece of ground. And so Kate was able to look at our soil samples each year, and on the land that we've managed for 10 years, you know, we've increased our total carbon in the soil by about 150%. And the surprising thing was that increase in soil total carbon happened at deeper soil profile. So not just in the 0 to 5 inch layer, but from about 5 to 30 inches layer. And so when I'm managing, you know, my above ground livestock, I'm really thinking about the below ground livestock and the roots. I think on the ethical side, what is really fascinating is that actually, if you were to weigh the total microbes in the soil in a given acre, it actually could equal the same weight of 2 steers. I'm actually creating an environment where more life exists underneath the ground than almost above the ground.
That's Mark Cesario, co-owner of Meeting Place Pastures, again, a grass-fed beef farming operation in Cornwall. Mark, thank you very much for calling in. So, Meredith Niles, we're looking at all of these different ways, and we started the show with the question, should I stop eating meat? Should I go vegan? Should I stop eating animal products altogether?
In the short term, do the things that you can do right now that help your household. To me, that's food waste reduction. I think if we start there, we can eliminate a lot of production that is not going to be utilized, which helps minimize greenhouse gas emissions. You know, my concerns about these black and white, you should stop eating meat or you should always eat meat, is that I don't think it's going to be feasible. The whole world is not going to become vegan unless, barring some crazy unforeseen circumstances. We're really talking about sort of a 30% diet shift that the average person is willing to make. I also want to impart that I think we really do need multiple solutions here. All of the most recent research really suggests that we need farmers like Mark to implement those practices, and we need people to stop wasting food, and we should also think about what we're consuming and what might be on our plate. So we should really be doing all of these things if we actually want to get to that 1.5 degree world that the IPCC talked about.
That was Meredith Niles, professor in the Food Systems Program at UVM. She was helping us explore possible solutions to slow the effects of predicted climate changes in our region. And it turns out that just as there are multiple causes for climate change, there are also many solutions. Perhaps it starts small, as Meredith Niles suggested, with changes we can make in our own habits and in our own households. And then, of course, we can always push for whatever action we think is necessary at the state, federal, and global levels.